Host Network Privacy Podcast, episode 31.
This is not an attempt to ban TikTok. It's an attempt to make TikTok better. Tic-tac-toe. A winner.
Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
Checking for me, no one checking on me, so I had to go run up a check. I got the message, homie, ain't no flexing on me. My attorney gon' call and collect. Blessings on blessings for me, my success has only made them envious. They got upset. I had to put all their egos in check. I want the money
put
the to
egos in check.
And I heard you know so and so, you're not a threat, cause I really know so and so. They like my family.
A lot of people
so
are trying to put a lot of people's egos in check. And the end result is more freedom stripped away, more digital liberty stripped away. What's going on, everyone? This is Simon, the Closed Network Privacy Podcast, episode 31, recorded today, Sunday, March 24th, 2024. And it's been a while. It's been a minute since I have recorded an episode. Actually, it's been almost just a little over 2 months. And in that time frame, I've had a lot going on with life and health. I had major knee surgery. I kind of knew it was coming. The last podcast I did, I was in the middle of trying to figure out what was going on with my doctor, and after X-rays and MRIs, determined that I did need surgery. So actually, like 2 weeks after the last podcast, I had pretty major knee operation. Total ACL replacement, and also had to fix a major meniscus tear that had folded back over itself. It was pretty wild, all from crashing on a one wheel, which if you haven't listened to previous episodes, it's just a electric skateboard with one wheel in the center and you ride it like a skateboard. And it did malfunction. It has malfunctioned, and I am pursuing my options around that. And, not really the litigious type, but I would like to maybe have some people held responsible if it's malfunctioned, which it seems to have been. Won't really talk about it that much until after I figure out what my options are. But I hope that you've been doing well. I've been recovering. I'm doing much better. Not that it's really, I mean, people get hurt all the time, so things could have been a lot worse. And I'm grateful for where I'm at with everything, but it has limited my mobility, especially coming downstairs where my studio and office are. I say studio, it's like literally a desk in my office where I do everything. So if you have a picture in your head, yeah, it's not like super fancy or anything like that. It's just, you know, where I do the recording at. So I hope everyone's doing well, and I don't know where you are in the world, but it's starting to warm up. I'm getting that spring itch to go outside and do stuff. Of course, I can't run for another 4 months. Running is a big part of one of my, I don't know if you call it a hobby. I think it's just a way to keep myself sane, is to run a lot. And I haven't been able to do that or anything like that. I'm actually just now kind of back to walking normal. So it'll be a few more months before that. Hopefully I can get into some mountain biking in the next month or two. But anyways, things are good. overall, and I really appreciate the support and people reaching out, and obviously appreciate the supporters, our Patreon supporters. Thank you. I really, really appreciate that. Michael Bates, Richard G, and Turquoise Panda, Bon, Circus Media, Pixel Jones, White Coat. Thanks to Mattis Max, of course, on Intelligence 7, always coming in clutch, helping me out, pick up the pieces and dodge spam bots and all that fun stuff. We are looking at possibly adding some new infrastructure to the closed network community that might be like a Discord server, which is kind of like a forum where we can also collaborate on how-tos. And what I was thinking is it'd be kind of cool to have how-tos for privacy and security and technology stacks and stuff like that, to where people could kind of go and use as a reference point. Because right now there are some good sources, but they become out of date kind of quickly, especially when you're talking about open source projects, because sometimes there might be a really cool project that pops up and then doesn't get any updates for a period of time. There could be some security vulnerabilities that are not patched. And we want to make sure that, you know, though we are using as much open source software as we can, that it's also not out of date, because that could be, you know, present a problem. There's two major focuses for my content. One is security. Security doesn't always entail open source software. Most times it can, and we try to make that happen. But then there's privacy, which also is more like tactics and obviously tools and things you can use that aren't necessarily always open source either. I try to use as much open source software as I can, because it limits the attack surface from CVEs or vulnerabilities that haven't been patched or discovered yet, like zero-day attacks. Doesn't mean that there aren't any with open source software. It just means that there are more eyes generally looking at it, because people have access to the source code versus, say, like Apple or Microsoft or closed source software and hardware. It's just been released that Apple Silicon, there's a break in its encryption and getting access to encryption keys if you have physical access to the hardware that doesn't really seem to be patchable right now. Will Apple find a way around this to fix it in the future? Maybe. But if you are a high value target for being targeted to be hacked, I would not be running in processor Mac if people could get physical access to your machine. So that's a perfect example, right? And, you know, we're always experimenting and trying different things, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But there's a lot of kind of like news I just kind of wanted to cover and kind of get into the future of things, because there's a kind of attack in different countries on multiple fronts, both in India, the European Union, in UK, in the United States. And though we have listeners all over the world, a lot of these are interconnected because of the sharing agreements between government agencies to share information and provide access. And a lot of times it's even governments buying data from data brokers, which are being collected from a myriad of sources, whether it's big tech companies, whether it's communication providers. And you kind of have to have shields up on all fronts at this point. And I'm going to kind of, some of the news articles I'm going to talk about go into that in this like kind of virtual, I don't know, you ever played Halo? Any of you gamers out there, or Helldivers 2? I've been playing Helldivers 2. You get these bubble shields and you can deploy a bubble shield. And if you go inside of it, nothing can really attack you as long as you're on the inside. And I feel like in real life, we need a bubble shield for our person, our data, our information, our whereabouts, because everything is being exploited in a way that is really disheartening, and it's stripping away more and more and eroding our kind of our ability to have agency over our person in our information, our communications, our financial transactions, everything. And I feel attacked. It's also kind of squirrely here in the United States. It's 2024. We have an election, a presidential election this year. So there's a lot of other weird stuff going on. And advertisers ramp up their marketing. And part of that is exploiting ways of getting information to get their ads targeted to the undecided or the centric, centrist voters. And in doing so, people are being kind of subconsciously manipulated. And it's mostly disinformation on all sides. And that's like, doesn't matter really. Left, right, center. They all play the same game. Sometimes one team is better than the other at that game, and other times they're not. I don't know if you've ever seen like the Ides of March or, you know, some of these like Wag the Dog movies. It's like things where it's like it doesn't appear to be as it is. It only appears to be what you see and what you hear. And control of that narrative is a big part of what plays into how third-party big tech companies, for example, like X with Elon, love them, hate them, whatever. It's like how they're targeted or what the focus is on what information will be amplified and which will be suppressed. And whether that's whistleblowers for Boeing or whistleblowers anywhere, anyone that's trying to reveal information that exposes truth, which could bring harm to a corporation that is trying to generate profits for shareholders, can be dangerous, just equally dangerous as it would be for exposing that kind of practice about government agencies and how that is used against the very people they're, air quotes, allegedly trying to protect. And a lot of these, you know, air quotes of terrorism and child, you know, protection, safety measures and all that kind of stuff are used in a way to manipulate you into thinking that if you only give up just a little bit more, then we can catch the bad guys. And it's a farce. It's absolutely, like, I have had, you know, over the years, deprogram myself to almost just think everything is complete BS that I hear from the media and that there's a hidden agenda behind it. And what is that? So if I'm being told something to do or a politician, like that clip I played at the beginning of the podcast about TikTok, right? U.S. is trying to ban TikTok unless ByteDance sells into a company or corporation that isn't under the control of China, that they'll ban it. And this has come up a couple times in the past where they've tried to ban TikTok. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of TikTok. I'd rather, you know, most of these social media platforms kind of die off, so to speak. But the reality is I also am kind of a freedom first minded individual, and I don't think people should be restricted to use technology. I'll be talking in a minute too, or a few minutes probably, about the EU committee approving the ban on anonymous crypto transactions via hosted wallets. This and it's all under the guise of anti-money laundering, which the biggest players in anti-money laundering, at least in the United States, are banks. The CIA likely is probably one of the largest offender at money laundering schemes. So it's always ironic to me when I see this kind of stuff come out from governments who are like, we're only trying to protect you. We're trying to save you from the terrorists. Therefore, we need access to all your financial data and your transactions above a certain amount. And we're also banning the ability for you to conduct commerce on a peer-to-peer level with wallets that you are a custodian for with cryptocurrencies. That's absolutely insane to me. And number two is like they're trying to ban something that's math. And they don't really have, I mean, they can impose all the bans and laws they want. What it really ends up doing is criminalizing your law-abiding citizens. It's kind of making law-abiding citizens think about their actions in a way that says, well, I've been doing it this way. If I continue doing it this way, though, now I'm a criminal. I'm a potential criminal. And there's no victim involved. You're conducting a financial transaction with, you know, engaging in a social contract with another individual on an agreed upon service or exchange of, you know, cryptocurrency for a product or a service. Because they can't be involved in the middle for taxation purposes, as well as also being able to, you know, classify those individuals, they'll just make it illegal. They'll just make you a criminal. And I feel like with all tech and communication and financial stuff, like those are the things that really give us individual freedoms to communicate and share ideas with each other. and show like our freedom of expression through contributing to a cause or a project, if you will. And now that's going to be infringed on by the so-called overlords that are there to protect us. And if you can detect a little bit of cynicism and frustration in my voice and what I'm saying, then you know you're on the money, because it's getting irritating. And in the last couple of months, we've seen a lot of these things come to fruition, where those who actually do real crime will go unpunished, but they want to punish the ones that haven't committed a crime, and they're going to make it so you do commit the crime. Before I get into it, I just want to say, Gabriel Custodiate from the Watchman Privacy podcast, I've always enjoyed, I doubt he listens to my podcast, maybe he does, but we've had quite a bit of engagement on Twitter over the last couple of years, and he's ending the show for now. So that's another one that is no longer going to be producing podcasts. The website's already been taken down. I don't really understand. I mean, this is just kind of a thing for me, like Michael Bazell for the Privacy and Security OSINT podcast, and now Gabriel Custodiate with the Watchman Privacy podcast, is to like, why take down the content? Like, if you want to stop doing the podcast, I understand, but there's so much good information in those podcast episodes that new people who are just coming into the awakening, what's happening to them. I won't say woke, because that means something completely different. I'll say awakening into the reality, kind of unplugging from the matrix and going like, oh crap, this is how the meat's made. These are how the hot dogs are made. Wow, did not realize that. Those episodes are such great resource and starting point for a lot of people that it sucks. I know some people have them archived, but that they're no longer available through the normal RSS feed distribution through their websites. And I kind of wish they would just leave them up, because it's so much work and it's so much time, and there's great interviews and conversations and resources. Yes, some of them might be out of date, but I really wish they would have left those up. But in the space, though, I've really appreciated and enjoyed their content, and wish them luck with whatever it is they move on to do or whatever they're doing next. You can get burnout from that kind of stuff. I get it. And so, you know, I just wish that they could have left the podcast episodes up. So having said that, though, there is a new kid on the block, Ray. Well, he's not that new. Well, I mean, fairly new in the last few months. There's a new privacy podcast that I've been enjoying called The Lockdown Podcast. The website is lockdown.media. And it's pretty good. I really, he's got a pretty deep background in network security, information security, and just has an interesting, fresh delivery and perspective on the topics that I cover as well, oftentimes. And if you're looking for another privacy podcast to add to your podcast app, I would definitely check, you know, at least consider checking that out, lockdown.media. I think you can also just search for the Lockdown Podcast and whatever you're using. Hopefully you're using a privacy-respecting podcast app, a podcast 2.0 app. I use Podverse and Antennapod. Those are the two primary ones I use. But, you know, wherever you're listening, you can probably just search it up and find it and check it out. So anyways, so some big stuff going on right now. The U.S. is suing Apple. That's just come about in the last few days. The Department of Justice is going to be like suing them over antitrust practices and anti-competitive practices. And we'll be kind of curious to see how this plays out, because I remember in the late 90s, this happened with, I think it was like 99, 2000, around that time, where they went after Microsoft for Internet Explorer and anti-competitive practices. And so I kind of wonder sometimes too, if these types of things are triggered because someone wasn't playing ball, or there wasn't, maybe there was a gentleman's agreement or an understanding, and maybe for whatever reason that's not happening. So they're going to threaten them with lawsuits. Not that I, you know, don't know if it's deserved. Apple has certainly done a lot of things to lock out the integration or compatibility, I guess, with non-Apple users as it pertains to things like iMessage and FaceTime and these different types of communication applications. one thing that really irritates me is, and hopefully I understand Apple's supposed to roll out support for RCS sometime this year, but what really annoys me is that when you have a lot of people that you do interact with that are on iPhones and you're using Android, whether it's stock Android or Graphene OS or Calyx OS or something of that nature, that text messaging is absolutely 100% open and available for carriers to read. It's not end-to-end encrypted, and you have to be very, very careful. And getting iPhone users to use a different messaging app that is privacy respecting, like say Simple X or you know, Threema or Signal or, you know, anything really, is challenging because in their minds, they're already using an encrypted messaging application, which it is, you know, iMessage is. And, but it's like, if you're not also using Apple Messages, then you don't get to participate in that. And I wish there was an easier way to have those interactions between two different platforms of users and it without creating more friction of like, hey, go download this app. A lot of people in the world use WhatsApp and that kind of stuff. So in the US and kind of like from what I understand, the UK and, you know, I don't know about Canada, but I mean, like, I don't know. It might be a heavy US thing with iPhones where there's definitely a big wall or a block that just people can't wrap their head around where it's like, if you're a green bubbler, you're less than. And it's so maybe this will help cure that. So I don't know. And if, you know, if Apple does roll out RCS encryption into their app, so when you're messaging someone over SMS to encrypt that communication, that would be huge. That'd be massive. And I know a lot of people are thinking like, well, you know, if you only talk to your friends and family and you're not talking on Signal, don't talk to me. But there's a lot of instances where even in professional environments that this is happening. And if you are, you know, trying to communicate with a client or a colleague and you're getting login information from each other or you're updating each other on the status of, say, a project that if someone got information about could lead to something, say, like insider trading or just leaking the information. I mean, these are big security problems, and it can be easily rectified with the rollout of RCS or using something else that's more universal or universally accepted. It's interesting to see that Apple did roll out their quantum protocol for like, you know, their end-to-end encryption for iMessage against quantum computing brute force and compared it directly to Signal. I think it's called like PQ3 or PQ3, I think is what it's called. I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting that they picked Signal because that kind of like elevates Signal. And I know that Signal has its problems with the phone number identifier and things like that, but it has been kind of a gold standard for end-to-end encrypted communications for multi-platform. And yes, there are some other applications that I prefer and probably you do too, but Signal's kind of the easy one to get people, whether they're on Android or iPhone or whatever, to kind of at least easily move over to or use alongside their regular SMS / iMessage app. And I feel like that's probably why, is just that the longevity they have in the user base. Though I do think that there are some better solutions for sure that don't tie your identity to a mobile number, but it's still better than the alternative, which is exposing potentially the conversation and all the amount of information through non-encrypted SMS. So yeah, the US is, you know, suing Apple. There's not a whole lot of details that, you know, basically the DOJ alleges that Apple blocks super apps. These are things like apps that have microtransaction capability inside the app and things like that. They have a huge commission fee that they charge. No matter how big or small your company is, no matter how much revenue you're generating, it's, I think, 30%. So their super apps would be like something like WeChat or something like that, you know, in China, applications where you can do multiple things inside of it and have microtransactions inside. So it says, you know, they are suppressing the mobile cloud streaming services. It blocks cross-platform messaging apps, like I was just mentioning, limits third-party digital wallets, because right now, if you have an iPhone, you can only use the Apple Wallet. The Apple Wallet is where your credit card information is stored, boarding passes for airplanes, tickets, for shows and movies and, you know, sporting events, that kind of thing. So there's no third party app, you know, wallet that you could use, or a different vendor app that you could use if you wanted to use something different. So what they're saying is you're kind of locked into the ecosystem and the apps that they have developed themselves. And their argument is like, well, we can only ensure the safety, security, and privacy of our users if we control everything. And there is some merit to that for sure. But at the same time, what it does is it kind of creates them as a superpower within the mobile computing space, because no one can really compete with them. This also goes to the smartwatches, where they say, like, hey, if you have an Apple Watch, you should be able to connect it to an Android phone and this and that. And then Apple said, hey, we actually tried for 3 years to make that a possibility, and we just couldn't do it. You know, we just couldn't do it. We couldn't get there with too many technical limitations, blah, blah, blah. And really, I mean, it's kind of, from a privacy standpoint, we wouldn't really want to use that stuff. But from just a free market point of view, it would be nice to have more interoperability, kind of like having open standard protocols like TCP/IP, right? Like, you can buy a network card from 1,000 different manufacturers, and we're kind of getting there in the computing space with ARM-based tech and companies, you know, starting to work on their own silicon, their own processors. For the longest time, we've really just had Intel or AMD. Back in the day, we had RISC and different, but there's always been very few options. Then things like Raspberry Pi kind of came around, and low power, high efficiency chips, especially for doing specific tasks. And I feel like we're kind of maybe about to go into a new age of potentially more companies being able to compete in that space for processors. But in this context of tech with messaging and everything, it looks like either A, Apple didn't pay the right people, or reneged on a contract or a social contract or a gentleman's agreement. They're being targeted. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of that, because as we've all seen in the EU, they've forced Apple to make decisions which only benefit everybody else, like standardizing USB-C ports, being able to sideload apps. So it's starting, they're like, there's a chink in the armor now. Like, they're kind of, so I think maybe that's also why the DOJ is going after him, because they've seen the success that the EU has had in imposing changes to Apple. Like, hey, if you want to sell your products here, then you got to adhere to some of these laws, these standards that we've created. And if you don't, that's considered anti-competitive and you won't sell your stuff here. And that's a huge, user base to exclude themselves from, so they conform, right? iPhone 15 came out. Guess what? USB-C ports. Now they're working on, I don't know if it's fully rolled out, but, you know, the ability to install apps third party, or through a third party sideloader, maybe a third party store, if you will. See, if you're on Graphene OS or Android in general, but like for me on Graphene OS, like, I install my apps from, some come from different places, right? I can download F-Droid. You can use Aurora Store. You can use Google Play and Google, you know, in a sandboxed environment. You install the apps directly from there. I also have apps that I install directly from GitHub repos via Obtainium. So I get the freedom and the choice to discover apps in different places and install them. Now, granted, you also want to be careful, and there's a lot of risk sometimes installing applications from unknown or untrusted sources. Like, you want to kind of do your homework, but at the same time, I'd rather have that risk than just be locked out completely from ever installing any of that software and using it how I want to. See, it kind of goes back to this idea that, like, you should be able to buy the device, and it should be open enough, right, to have some choice in what you're going to install. And this is what happened back with Microsoft in the late 90s and the early 2000s, is they kind of integrated Internet Explorer into the operating system as not just the web browser, but as the everything browser. So what happened was, it would be very easy for it to always revert as the default browser. And that would make it difficult, you know, for other competing browsing companies. Like, back then, it was Mozilla, I think Opera, there were some other, I was actually really going back, it was Netscape, right? But it kind of created this, like, advantage for them, because their tool would be used for browsing the web. Which also means they get more telemetry information and what, you know, potentially web search history and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of look at that as what's going on here is Apple's just gotten so big, not big as in revenue or user base, but big in the control of who can come in and to the ecosystem and who can play in that sandbox with them. And it's very, very, very little. There's actually an article I'll link in the show notes to a Verge article, which also has an embedded YouTube video. I did watch this video the other day by Vanderbilt Law School professor Rebecca Allensworth, probably butchering her name, H-A-W Allensworth. And she has just kind of like a good brief explanation on it. And there's not a lot of detail, and this is probably something that will go on potentially for months or even years. So I don't expect that we're going to see a whole lot of stuff just in the short term, but we'll be following this as it unfolds and how it, you know, kind of will impact non-Apple users as well as Apple users. Because love them or hate them, I mean, Apple's a big software ecosystem, and it's like this like compatibility layer that we all have to figure out how to work within. And for me, myself, professionally, I do use Apple products as well. So I'm also talking from like first-person user perspective for work-related stuff, and then from like a non-work, from like a, you know, just a regular dude trying to use tech, using like Linux and using a Pixel and that kind of thing. How do I interface with Apple users with as little friction as possible? So if we can find a happy medium in there, I'd like to see that. RCS would be a great start. Check that out. I'll have that linked in the description below. Like I said, there's not a whole lot of information, but we're going to see what comes of that. But going back to the EU, I mentioned earlier, the EU committees approve a ban on anonymous crypto transactions via hosted wallets. What's a hosted wallet? So that's a wallet that you are the custodian for, meaning you contain the private keys. You have the private keys for that wallet and nobody else does. As opposed to a hosted wallet or a wallet that you have with, say, Coinbase or Strike or an exchange, essentially. If you have cryptocurrency in a wallet with an exchange is just anywhere where you're either doing transactions, you're buying or selling your crypto, you don't possess the keys, and they will report their customers, meaning you, all of the financial transaction information to whatever reporting agencies that they are obligated to do so. Versus if you download a wallet or host a wallet and you are the only person that has the keys to it, they want to ban that. They want to ban the ability for you to have a wallet that only you have the keys to, because they want access to know who you are. That's part of the KYC, know your customer process of, they don't necessarily trying to ban crypto. They're trying to ban the ability for people to have crypto without them knowing. That's essentially what this comes down to. So a majority of European Parliament lead committees have approved a ban on the cryptocurrency transactions of any value made through a hosted crypto wallet. And it says this comes out of this is articles on the Cointelegraph. I'll have this linked in the description. It says this comes amid the European Council's and Parliament's provisionary agreeing an expansion parts of the European Union's anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing laws to cover the cryptocurrency market. According to an ex post by Patrick Breyer, who's a member of the European Parliament for the, I guess it's the Pirate Party, but it's the Piraten Partei Deutschland Party, a Pirate Party of Germany. The majority of the EU Parliament's lead committees approved the new AML laws on March 19th. There's a lot that goes into this, but there's also there's a related article about the UK Treasury also seeking to improve AML through crypto supervision changes. I see this potentially even coming to the US, and I think that a lot of policymakers in the United States would even like to see this potentially even in other neighboring countries like Canada, where it's basically going to say, if you don't have, like, you can have cryptocurrency, sure, but it's got to be with a regulated provider or a regulated monitored hosting service, like, you know, your investment bank or Coinbase or Gemini or something of that nature, that you can't just mine Bitcoin and have it hosted in a personal wallet. You can't just sell something for Bitcoin and have it hosted in a personal wallet. A lot of this is kind of insane because the toothpaste is already out of the tube and putting it back in is just impossible. It's math. And there's so many easy ways to transact and conduct those kinds of commerce exchanges online with people without the government ever finding out. Now, there are ways to do it also where you expose yourself pretty easily and could potentially be held liable for those transactions. But there's a lot you can do to just basically run your own node, generate your own wallet from that node. You could even do it offline. You could generate, you could download JavaScript and generate a paper wallet that never exists. You could broadcast transactions over SMS. There's so many ways. I don't know how you're going to ban this. All they're really doing is, this is kind of like going back to the beginning of my rant in the beginning of the podcast, was really just want to kind of make a criminal of you. Even though there's no victim, even though you're not doing anything illegal or wrong, they want full access, just like they want to see big tech companies open up back doors to end-to-end encrypted files, server services, like where you put your documents and your photos, to communication protocol and within their messaging ecosystems. Like, oh, you can have an intimate message encryption. Like, we want you to stay encrypted, but we want to see the message before it does get encrypted. Like, that's not an encryption anymore. That's just an encryption layer. Like, if you're messaging me and I'm messaging you, but someone has the ability to capture the message and then encrypt it, then send it, that's not end-to-end. That's a middleman attack. And that's what all this is for what I see within the crypto space is, like, not only are they trying to ban the self-hosted wallets, they're taking this even further with like financial transactions on limiting like how much, you know, you could transact with someone individually. Like I think it's 10,000 euros if you're with a commercial company in cash and 3,000 on an individual layer. Meaning, here it is. It says the new AML legislation applies certain limits for cash transactions and anonymous cryptocurrency payments. Under the new rules, anonymous cash payments over 3,000 euros will be banned in commercial transactions, and cash payments over 10,000 euros will be completely banned in business transactions. So buying a car off of somebody off of Craigslist or whatever, like if it's over a certain amount, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, like, you can't do that. It's, you've got to do it through like a check or through a bank. It's got to be recorded. A lot of that is for, you know, tax purposes, and a lot of it is for just them wanting to know. And it's not for anyone's safety. It's to have ultimate supreme being knowledge of what's going on in all their citizens' lives. And I think, you know, for the longest time, that's what's been happening in the United States with having to report over like $600, you know, you do an Airbnb weekend with a bunch of friends and, you know, everyone's PayPaling you money or Venmoing you money. It's like, it's up to you now. The burden is onto you to prove that these are like paying you back. This isn't like a sale of something because it's getting reported. Like these one-on-one individual transactions are all, they want full visibility into all of that. And so this is not a good precedent. And I think, you know, that this could trickle over and definitely into the UK, and I'm sure in the United States as well as other countries, Australia and some of the other ones that want to have full supreme being knowledge. They want to be the super lords of their citizens. And I'm not going to tell you how to feel about it. I'm just, you know, some people, I mean, you're entitled however you feel and what you think. But if you honestly think that these practices are actually going to stop terrorism, stop money laundering, like it's just like you really need to stop and do some research on actual money laundering. The Hated One has a fantastic video from like, gosh, it must be a couple years ago now, on HSBC. There's countless documentaries and sources on the CIA doing a lot of shady stuff globally to literally launder money for other causes that they couldn't officially fund. And those actual acts would be defined today as terrorism, rebelization of countries, economic hitmen. It's absolutely insane. It's not that I don't want to find ways to stop terrorism. Just like I don't want to find ways to help stop the exploitation of children in real life and online, I do, absolutely. But this is not the way to go about it. Just like device scanning isn't the way to go about it. When you giving up all of your privacy under the guise to catch the air quote bad guys, and when the bad guys aren't even, they're too savvy anyways. Yes, they might catch some, but that's their job. Their job is to find them and investigate and set honeypots and do those kinds of things, and not, you know, just, hey, we're just buying all the information, we're just going to spy on everyone all the time, all the things. Because, you know, it's just a front, basically. The excuse is just a front to get to the end result, which is total domination, total control. So speaking of Apple, going back to Apple for a minute, it looks like, and I don't know how verified this is, but there's some pretty good verified sources. I have an Axios article regarding AI and being implemented. So AI is like kind of the, of course, everywhere. Everyone's been hit in the face with it. You probably have interacted with AI on some level, whether you're just trying out an app or using ChatGPT or Midjourney, and some of it's really cool. I've used it quite heavily for a lot of different things. I'm a techie. I like learning how to use this stuff, but I also think that there's like we're in that infancy to toddler stage with AI right now, and that companies are trying to be the first or fastest in rolling out AI into literally everything. Like Microsoft's going heavy with this, with Copilot, and trying to just ram it into your desktop, ram it into everything, into search, into Bing. Google's kind of been doing that with Bard, which is now Gemini AI. And I feel like it's way too soon to be shoehorning this into our mobile devices, but they're going to try. I mean, this is the next step, because the mobile device is the most widely popular computer, personal computer that people use and carry around with them everywhere. Well, it's been kind of interesting to see what Apple's doing, because it doesn't really, like, they haven't really done much yet. Now, there's been a lot of acquisitions of technology, AI companies, and their skill sets with their employees. I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone, I mean, I'm sure some people know, but there's a lot of speculation going on with what Apple's going to do to keep up with the AI race. Well, now it looks like potentially they could be considering the idea of using Gemini AI or some variation of Google's AI incorporated into iOS 18. And also, I have another article that I'll link below. It's a Forbes article about Google update, shows how the Bard or Gemini AI may work with your messaging app, right? So let's look at why, right? So what they're trying to do is add convenience. So in order for it to be more convenient for you as the user, individual, it's got to be very contextual to you. So therefore, it needs access to read all of your messages so it can understand context. And in one way, this sounds like a cool idea, right? If you had an AI bot that knew all your email, knew all the meta information for your photos, your location history, knew the context and who you're contacting and messaging with through text message, iMessage, Signal, whatever, right? Then it could be a much better assistant when you say, hey, what were the dates that me and my friends were talking about for going for a golf trip in this summer? You know, like, you don't even remember, but it knows everything. It's already indexed all of your stuff, and it could tell you, hey, oh yeah, that's coming up in June. We're talking about the third weekend of June. Here's some flights that are available. Here's one that's the cheapest one, and here's an Airbnb in the area that would house all of you, no problem. This is what it would cost, and this is what it would cost per person. Do you want me to go ahead and book that for you? And you say, like, yeah, that's great. That's awesome. You know, that's what they're trying to achieve with AI on the mobile device in the example of it being an assistant. And on paper, that sounds amazing. Like, what a time to be alive, where you could literally talk to this inanimate object. It knows your life better than you do, and it can actually, like, help streamline your life and, like, make plans for you and purchase tickets and find the best deal and all that stuff, and then keep you updated on changes. And hey, hey, Gemini AI, also, I want to go and we also want to do a deep sea fishing on that same weekend. Is there a time that would work? Oh, yeah, you could do it on Thursday or, you know, Saturday afternoon at 3:00. Here's a charter. This is how much it costs. You know, it's kind of like, oh, wow, that is kind of cool. I mean, regardless, I think that's cool. I think that's like living in the future. But what's the trade-off is that now big tech has even more access to everything about you and everything that you've done and everything that you want to do, everything that you're asking it. It can even identify your IQ level. They already know your credit score. They already know your job, your history, your political stance and views. So how much easier would it be from a marketer now to have very, very focused advertising content, both audio, video, and smart display and all that to target users, because that's how Google makes its money. Google makes its money from advertising, right? They offer all of these free services, not for free, but to service their marketers or publishers who are paying for access. That's how they make money. So if you have a free Gmail account and use Google Docs and, you know, you're using all the freebie Google stuff, you know, everyone's heard 1,000 times you are the product, right? Unless you're paying for the product, you're the product. But it's like even further than that is like you're actually not just the product, but you're like digital gold for them. You are the company asset, if you will. Like you're the IP of that company. Now, sometimes, you know, companies will sell that data outright, but what Google does is sell access directly to it, based on all sorts of different variables or different attributes when it comes to marketing advertising. So this, to me, is kind of like got my head scratching a little bit, because regardless of my disdain for Google and or Apple, like they've both kind of done things independently that have been good for the user in the sense of like security. But they also have to be secure because they're going to be the biggest targets, the biggest honeypots. And so I think that some of the reasons why like Apple has rolled out advanced data protection, which allows you to and encrypt all of your files, your iMessage, your iCloud backups, everything basically except your email and your calendar, is to limit the liability for them. I mean, yes, it's good for the users, but I think it's even better for them because in the event that somewhere down the road there is a breach, they can say, well, we offer, it's an opt-in, advanced data protection. If you didn't have it enabled, then sorry, you should have encrypted your stuff, right? And I do tend to feel that same way, but a lot of people just aren't really educated that option is even available to them. So now I'm like, this is kind of an odd juncture where Google and Apple are kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong. Google and Apple have been in bed for years, right? Google's the default search engine in Safari on the iPhone. And they've made, I don't know, billions and billions of dollars over the years from Google for being the default search engine. It's the default search for Siri. When you ask Siri something, it's a Google search. You know, let me look it on the web for you. And it pulls back those Google search results. So, I mean, is this kind of the end of the separation if this goes down this road of using Gemini/Bard's Google AI in Apple phones and iOS devices as an AI search to integrate, or an AI assistant to integrate with Siri? Like, I don't know. I mean, we'll probably find out later this year. It's just, there's a lot of shady stuff going on. So this article, Axios, is Apple, Google stock jumps on reported talks of iPhone Gemini AI partnership, which of course it will. Both Apple and Google's both had a nice jump. Even if this isn't like 100% fleshed out, like just the talks that these are happening, because it's going to create a super monopoly, right? So if you're a shareholder, like this is good news for you. Because I think there's like 2.2 billion iPhone users on the planet or something like that, or iOS users. Now that might include all devices. Like if you own an iPhone, you also have an iPad and probably have macOS or something like that. Like generally Apple users have more than one just Apple device. So I don't know if that's devices or users. I think it's devices, but that's like potentially 2 billion plus Google AI users right there, right? If this comes to fruition. So it says why it matters. Google would gain scale. Oh, yeah, I found the, here it is. It says Google would gain scale in the AI arms race. It's kind of an interesting selection of terms there, arms race, if it had access to Apple's 2.2 billion active devices, the bulk of which are likely iPhones. For Apple, inserting generative AI features into smartphones could help rejuvenate demand for devices. In other words, the partnership, should it come to fruition, makes a massive amount of sense for both sides. Tech analyst Ben Thompson wrote this, you know, this morning. He says, investors agreed that Google shares closing 4.4% Monday. Apple jumped over 2.7% before finishing up. Says the tech giants already have a longstanding partnership, with Google paying to serve as the default search engine on Apple's Safari browser and the iPhone. But that could complicate the regulatory picture. It says the deal has played a big role in the Department of Justice's antitrust lawsuit against the search giant, which there's a different lawsuit for that. So the lawsuit's flying all over the place. The FTC is already looking into a huge AI investment by Microsoft, Amazon, and Google. It's like, at some point, there's really going to be like seven tech companies that really kind of control probably 90% of like the tech business. And then the rest is going to be like media services and that kind of thing. But as far as the giants, you know, those are the big ones, you know, are Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft. And yeah, sure. You know, the people who are making operating systems, people who are making devices, hardware devices and operating systems, it's kind of like that top tier layer. And then next would be integrated service solutions and service providers back in, you know, cloud providers, that kind of thing. And then next on top of that would be all of your applications, right? Like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, whatever. So the U.S. is trying to ban TikTok because they really don't want competition, is the way I look at it is. And they're also trying to control these players in the market and how much. Because like, I don't really think that the government is really thinking like, oh, well, it keeps competitors from popping up, new ones and stuff. Yeah, that's part of it. But a lot of it is, no, you need to play ball and we need to have some understandings. A, we have certain revenue expectations. There might be new tax implications. We also want more access. We might want to put a whole team of, you know, for the CIA or NSA or any other three-letter agency, we want to have a team inside your AI headquarters. That's what we want. We want to siphon all of this information because at some point, the government doesn't even really want to buy it anymore. They just want it. And so, right, you know, now they collect it themselves, but they also buy a lot of it, which is crazy, right? Taxpayers or dollars are being used to buy the very information, their own information to use against them. So this is just another thing to follow and be aware of. Like, I feel like sometimes Google does things that I like or that move in the right direction. Sometimes Apple does, but ultimately I feel like they're both moving in a direction that's ultimately just bad for the end user if you care about your privacy. And this would be like moving into this next evolution of mobile operating systems, I think is going to be a complete fundamental shift on how you're able to protect your data, because now the AI bots are going to basically be, it's just one, probably an opt-in, like, hey, you install this, you upgrade to iOS 18, you let Google AI Assistant index your entire life so that it can be the best assistant for you. Like, you just like agree, boom, there you go. And now it's indexing and sending off to an Apple server or a Google AI server your profile data, and it's going to be enormous. I mean, the amount of information that's already being sent is crazy, but I think that when we really move into a fully integrated AI companion on both Google and iOS, that it's going to be terabytes of information on you. Everywhere you go, everything you say, everything you search, every interaction you have, every photo you take, you know what I'm saying? Like everything you do, and it will be sold to you in the sense of like, well, the more we have, the more the language model has trained on you, the more we can personalize the assistant. So they're basically just there to serve you in that context. So, yeah, it's like a total Skynet takeover, you know? And then once, yeah, anyways, I'm gonna just kind of keep an eye on this and see where it goes. And, you know, to add insult to injury, we also have more information coming about automakers, you know, and sharing consumers' driving behavior with insurance companies without their knowledge. And so this is like another area of attack. That's why I feel like we're being attacked on all fronts, right? I need a bubble shield. So a lot of cars have newer cars, especially if they're made newer than, say, like 2017, 18, 19. They have a lot more updated telematics capabilities. Now, there's a myriad of ways that auto manufacturers have can get data on drivers' habits and things like that. A lot of it is just stored on the internal computer, and every time you go in for a service, whether it's a dealership or just go get an oil change or something, they have an OBD scan on your car, which also tells them information like, hey, have there been any check engine lights or any other faults that they need to know about to address maybe a sensor or some other component that's possibly failing, which could cause, you know, something bad to happen to the vehicle. But what's also happening is all these cars, these newer cars, have these essentially like a black box in them. Like if you're familiar with planes, when they crash, they dive down into the water, find the black box to get all the telemetry information of like what happened, what caused it, you know. Oh, they throttled up, they throttled down, an engine was losing oil pressure. You know, it gives them all that information. Well, cars are doing this like in a real time, but it's not just the performance of the car. It's like everything, like where you travel, how fast you go, how frequent you go, whether or not you brake hard, or what your average speed. I mean, there's so much information that's being collected. Well, now what's happening is it's also being used to assess risk for insurance purposes. So I'm going to just read this first part of this New York Times article, and I could have told you that this was happening because as soon as I saw the name involved, I was like, ah, yeah. It says Ken Dahl says he's always been a careful driver. The owner of a software company near Seattle, he drives a leased Chevrolet Bolt. Terrible car, in my opinion, but whatever. It's the car he drove. He says he's never been responsible for an accident. So he considers himself a safe driver. He's a software developer over in Seattle. He's never caused an accident. So it says, so Mr. Dahl, 65, was surprised in 2022 when the cost of his car insurance jumped by 21%. Quotes from other insurance companies were also high. One insurance agent told him his LexisNexis report was a factor. LexisNexis is a New York-based global data broker with a, air quote, risk solutions division that caters to the auto insurance industry and has traditionally kept tabs on car accidents and tickets. Upon Mr. Dahl's request, LexisNexis sent him a 258-page consumer disclosure report, which it must provide per the Fair Credit Reporting Act here in the United States. It says what it contained stunned him, more than 130 pages detailing each time he or his wife had driven the Bolt over the previous 6 months, and included the dates of the 640 trips, their start and end times, the distance driven, and an accounting of any speeding, hard braking, or sharp accelerations. The only thing it didn't have is where they had driven the car. It says on Thursday morning in June, for example, the car had been driven 7.33 miles in 18 minutes. There had been two rapid accelerations and two incidents of hard braking. It says according to the report, the trip details had been provided by General Motors, the manufacturer of the Chevy Bolt. LexisNexis analyzed that driving data to create a risk score for insurers to use as one factor of many to create a personalized insurance coverage. According to a LexisNexis spokesman, Dean Carney, eight insurance companies had requested information about Mr. Dahl from LexisNexis over the previous month. And Mr. Dahl says, you know, it felt like betrayal, Mr. Dahl said. They're taking information that I didn't realize was going to be shared and screwing with our insurance. Factoid, I worked for LexisNexis before they became LexisNexis. They were a company called ChoicePoint. And I worked for them for 3.5 years. And yeah, they built their business around assessing risk. That's kind of where I started out as a sysadmin and working within their application services. And, you know, back then I kind of thought we're definitely Big Brother, but you know, they've grown and grown and grown over the last two decades to this like monstrosity. They started out as a spinoff, I think it was from Equifax or Experian, which is a credit reporting agency, because they had all this information about claims history what was called Clue reports. It's like a claims list lookup report on home property. So if you have an insurance claim on your property, like say you have water damage or burst water pipe or something. You submit a claim with your insurance provider and they assess it and then they pay for it. In most cases, they pay to have it fixed. Well, the insurance companies, you know, they kind of hold this information close to their chest because they don't really want to share it because they don't really get any benefit from that. So what LexisNexis did, they started out as claims history report, is they were basically able to tell all these insurance companies like, hey, give us all your claims history information for free and pay us to access everybody else's claim history. So if you're trying to write a policy, an insurance policy for a policyholder, we can tell you information about them that you would like to know, whether you know you even want to sign this person or not, and if you do, what their premium should be. There's other factors too, like your age, sometimes some states your credit, and driving insurance, your motor vehicle report would be a big part of that, like how many speeding tickets and accidents you've had in the last 5, 7, 10 years. All of this is assembled, and they basically kind of perfected the model of analyzing and scoring it based upon certain criteria that each insurance company wanted, you know, to have. Like, they have certain rules, whether it's State Farm, Farmers, Geico, they all use them. All of them use them. And they even get interactive motor vehicle reports directly from the state. So you can order as a package. So when you walk into an insurance agent office and you say, hey, I'd like to get a quote, or you call them, or now it's all done online. Basically what happens is that request is sent to LexisNexis and says, hey, here's this insurer's information. Give me everything you've got. And that's what's being reported back, is now all of this driving pattern, all of this driving behavior and data. And it's actually, you know, kind of being done in an invasive way, because it's a form of spying on you as the user. So now you buy a car. It's got software, it's got stuff going on that you don't even know about, on top of, like, every time you go to get your car service, it's getting scanned. These companies are selling this information. They're selling it for marketing purposes. They're selling it for, you know, the companies, meaning that the collection companies and the manufacturers, in this case is GM, selling this information. It's like, you don't really own it. It's not yours. It's like you buy a new vehicle with all this capability, but you're really just paying for the pleasure of using the vehicle. But the vehicle itself is doing all this other crap in the background that you are completely unaware of. It's having all these conversations with its manufacturer, with like Carfax. And like, have you ever noticed, like, if you've gone and get your oil change and then you get an email from some sort of provider, you know, hey, it's time for another oil change. You're like, how do you know how many miles I've driven? Right? I mean, yes, you don't want to get your oil changed regardless of miles. Like, if you don't, you want to get a change at least once a year or every, you know, 5 to 10,000 miles, depending upon your vehicle and synthetic oil, and all that kind of stuff. But like, how does it know that? How does it know how many miles you got in your car? Because it's probably reporting it back. And every time you get it serviced, it's also reporting whether, like, what kind of service you had, if there was any recalls. Some of these, you know, consumers would think, well, that's a benefit. It keeps me updated with whether or not there's a recall. And yeah, that's true. There are some benefits. They have to provide a benefit. Otherwise, everyone would be revolting and burning these places to the ground, but they don't. And this is just another example of that, like, super invasive, like, overlord mentality. So now your car, your communications, you got the AI bot coming. Like, what else is coming? I didn't really mean for this to be such a drag. I actually, that's not at all what it is, but I just feel like personally attacked this year, 2024, starting off spicy. So moving into kind of switching back to the AI thing, I wanted to circle back with the Google update and showing how Bard/Gemini artificial intelligence could work with the Google Messages app. This is the default app that comes on Android for your SMS messaging, texting people. So this article actually came out at the end of June, but researchers have just unveiled a pre-release game-changing AI upgrade for Google Messages, but it's one with a serious privacy risk. And this is a Forbes article that I just mentioned a few minutes ago. It seems that Bard may risk to read and analyze your private message history. So how might this work? How do you maintain your privacy, and when might this begin? So they updated this article on January 29th, and it says, there's understandable excitement that Google is bringing Bard/Gemini to Google Messages, a ready-made ChatGPT-like UI for a ready-made user base of hundreds of millions of users, right? It's an AI assistant, in air quotes. Explains Bard's chat when asked that can improve your messaging experience from facilitating communication to enhancing creativity and providing information. It will be your personal AI assistant within your messaging app. So now not only am I talking about just on the phone as an app, but even within an app, in this case, Google Messages. It says, but Bard's chat also acknowledges that it may ask to analyze your messages to understand the context of your conversations, your tone, and your interests. It may analyze the sentiment of messages to tailor its response to your mood and vibe. It may analyze your message history with different contacts to understand your relationship dynamics, to personalize responses based on who you're talking to. Okay, so here comes the next privacy battlefield for smartphone owners still coming to terms with app permissions, privacy labels, tracking transparency, and with all those voice AI assistants eavesdropping scandals still fresh in the memory. Google's challenge will be convincing users that this doesn't open the door to the same kind of privacy nightmares we've seen before where user content and AI platforms meet. So there will be another less contentious privacy issue with your messages requests to Bard. These will be sent to the cloud for processing, used for training, and maybe seen by humans, albeit anonymized. This data will be stored for 18 months and will persist for a few days, even if you disable the AI, albeit manual deletion is available. So again, I mean, that's kind of just, you know, reiterating what I just said earlier about it has to have access to all of this in order for it to be as optimized as possible. And how much are you willing to give up that level of access and your privacy for the convenience, especially when these chat apps, a lot of them suck. They're not even that good. They're getting better, sure, but a lot of them are just god awful. And they all use different models too, and some of them have more access to larger language modeling data sets than others. But if, like for me, I really embrace AI, but I also like the idea of running it locally within my own environment. Matter of fact, one of my favorite YouTubers is Network Chuck. He actually recently had a video that I thought was really cool, talking about, hey, run your own AI, right? You can download, a lot of these models have been completely open sourced. One of them is actually even by Facebook under Meta. And they have this massive data set that they made available for freely for everyone to download and use. You should, right? I mean, you know, though I can't stand Meta, maybe, I mean, it's cool that they did that, because if we can download these models, we can actually use them to benefit ourselves. So I'm looking forward to potentially having some more AI integration, but AI that's running in my network, that's looking at my stuff only, and it's not sending anything to anyone. It's basically running and it's using GPUs or my Threadripper and things like that to do the analysis and generate feedback based upon the prompt or the query that I'm asking it, but doing it in a way that's private. And I look at AI as not just all bad, right? But it can be used badly. And right now, it's kind of like the early days of crypto. It's like the Wild West, and there's just AI running everywhere. And you don't, I mean, with all the deep fakes, the porn stuff is getting really bad. All this deep fake porn that's being done with AI, it's creating some big problems, and as well as in other spaces with misinformation and just, you know, just all sorts of wacky stuff. What's interesting, though, is the Hated One actually had some interesting input on the most recent video talking about AI. And I've seen this somewhere else where it's like at some point, though, like it's going to start degrading over time, because once AI has like learned everything, and it's like all new content going forward will be like AI generated. So the AI models will be learning from AI content, and it will start like inbreeding itself, you know, and I kind of like that makes sense to me. I think we're a long ways from seeing that, but it is like a degenerative AI over time, and it will be hard to decipher. Could you imagine like what life will be like in 2 decades from now, trying to decipher something that's got some historical significance, like maybe a news article or something about a particular event? and whether or not it was AI generated, and knowing about whether or not it was like accurate, or, you know, and so if you're doing a research paper and you're using an AI tool 20 years from now, that's looking back on other AI generated content, like, does it, you know, just start to like rewrite history in AI over and over again? I don't know. It's going to be weird. It's a weird time to be alive. I feel like I was born in the wrong time. I should have been born like 30 years earlier. Because now I'm just like, dude, this is a wild ride. Like, I mean, I'm kind of here for it, but I also kind of wish, I wish I wasn't sometimes. Does that make sense? I don't know. It makes sense in my mind. So I do have some other, articles. I'm going to skip over this one, which is, cause I'm probably going to come back to it. This is regarding the UK Investigatory Powers Act of 2016. It's being revisited and it's ugly. Apple has actually tried to come out and kind of poo-poo on this because it would put a lot of changes on them to allow more access to data within their, because, you know, now once there's been one battle once against Apple for like the EU and like sideloading and changing ports, now it's kind of like open season to get Apple to conform to country specific privacy laws and surveillance capabilities that Apple now has to decide either A, they're going to conform to it if these you know, Privacy Powers Acts get renewed with this in there saying we need access to everyone's data. So you got to figure it out. So Apple will either have to play ball or not provide those services in that country, which is also now a new monetary impact potentially to them, which means a fall in the share price, which means sharing, you know, profitability, a reduction of profitability. You understand how the cycle works, right? So there's an article I'm going to link to. It's from the end of January, the BBC, talking about how Apple has attacked proposals for the UK government to pre-approve any new security features introduced by tech firms. Because, yeah, this... the government wants to update this Investigatory Powers Act, and to do so it would require Apple and other, you know, communication and or software providers to allow more access. But I do want to get onto this article, the last topic, which is, I'll link to it. This is actually from AdGuard, the makers of the open source Docker image. It's an app that you can run kind of like Pi-hole to do your DNS management. And they, this article is actually from October of last year, 2023, but it's, I found it really insightful, talking about how mobile carriers make money off your data behind your back. So we talk a lot on this podcast and different episodes about phones, devices, iOS versus Android versus Graphene OS, because we're trying to limit our attack surface, if you will, and meta information. So having the ability to sandbox apps, create layers and compartmentalization with different like user profiles on our phone. I mean, number one, you're winning with Graphene OS off the rip because you don't have to log into the phone to use it. You just turn it on and you can just download an app from anywhere you want. There is no logging into it. Like with an iPhone, you have to create and use an Apple ID, especially if you want to download anything from the App Store, which is the only place you can get apps. And then with same thing with Android, it's kind of the same way. There, you know, I mean, yes, there are some ways you can kind of circumvent, but by and large, most people are logging into it with their Google account, and Apple, they're logging into with their Apple ID. So from the moment you do that, the device is like tagged to you and then your identity, because eventually you're going to put in some credit card information because you want to buy an app or something, and you want to use the wallet, right, to store your stuff. I mean, half of the reason why you want this device is because it does all those things, and it does them very well, but at the risk of giving up all your KYC, all your personal information. So now that tech provider knows for sure it's you. So we can obfuscate, or we can circumvent that whole thing by buying a Google Pixel, flashing Graphene OS on it, right? And now we can use a phone that we're not logging into with any personable, identifiable information. We can then also compartmentalize out our apps that we want to use, like social media apps, banking apps, traveling apps, and then just communication and email and that kind of stuff into different containers. So there's no cross-contamination. And that's what one of the things I love about Graphene OS. Well, there's a second component to that, the major one, which is what self-service provider you're using. And all of the major ones in the United States, when I say major ones, we're talking about like AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon, you know, as far as like the major players, this article goes into like, hey, this is what your provider is doing. Number one, T-Mobile's had like, what, 9 data breaches since 2018? I think the most recent one with like 37 million subscriber user information like dumped. So that's one attack area, is that these guys are big targets for getting access to subscriber information. And man, T-Mobile, dude, 9, I think it was like 9. I'd have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure they've had like 9 data breaches in the last 6 years. I think like 3 of them happened just last year alone, you know? So already, you know, that's my biggest concern, is like, dude, you guys can't even secure your own stuff, man. Like, really? Okay. What else are you going? What else are you doing? So it says how mobile carriers milk customer data for money. It says admittedly, consent is a tricky issue with mobile carriers. They may claim that they share customer data with their permission, but they may also trick them into giving it, you know, giving their subscribers giving into the EULAs. Says, having said all that, let's take care of a closer look at T-Mobile, a mobile carrier whose tracking program has been dubbed, air quotes, creepy, invasive, but also common. T-Mobile's privacy policy says that it collects app usage data from its customers and shares it with advertisers for relevant ads, unless the customers opt out. Notably, this only affects Android users, as Apple users are spared, which is not totally true. It says mobile advertising IDs, MAIDs, of iOS users, which is an identifier that is used to track user behavior and preferences for ad purposes, is not so readily available since 2021, and Apple introduced App Tracking Transparency, ATT, and the feature made it easier for iOS users to opt out of third-party tracking and made iOS devices a little less useful for advertising. But T-Mobile says it does not use app usage data to select advertisements per se. Instead, it analyzes to create models and inferences about the users, such as their interests, buying intentions, so on and so forth. It says this information is based on the name of the apps they have installed, how much time they spend on them. T-Mobile combines this data with the information that customers provide themselves, such as gender, age range, and shares it with advertisers alongside the user's MAIDs, which is the mobile ad tracking IDs. It says this enables advertisers to target ads based on the customer's profile. So, you know, it's kind of like, hey, we're just trying to like help you out. So, and you know, yes, some things have gotten harder for Apple users because of the ATT, the app transparency technology they rolled out, which means like, and they're trying to be more transparent about for the developers, like, hey, you got to say what you collect, and if you don't, you're not going to post your app. Like, they're pretty rigorous about that. Doesn't mean that they can't submit apps that are entirely invasive. They can. They just have to be transparent about it. But the users are still going to use them, right? Like TikTok and all this other stuff. For Verizon, it says T-Mobile's handling of user data is not unique. Verizon also collects and sells user data with different programs. It says one of them is the Business and Marketing Insights, which all users are automatically enrolled to. It says the program tracks how you use your phones by analyzing your web history, device location, apps, features, demographic data, and interests. Some of this data may come from third parties. Verizon then sells it in aggregate from advertisers unless you opt out. The other two programs are Customer Experience and Custom Experience Plus. Like, what a load of crap for this marketing stuff. With the latter being an opt-in, Customer Experience Plus collects more data in comparison to just customer experience. In addition to the websites you visit and the apps you use, it also logs the phone numbers customers call or receive calls from and device location data. It says Verizon claims they make efforts to avoid harvesting sensitive data such as visits to websites related to health and sexuality, as well as sensitive location data, by using special filters. But as we've seen with Meta and others, such filters may not be very effective. Verizon also says it does not share information collected for customer experience programs, which third parties for them use their own advertising. However, it admits that it shares the data with service providers who work for us. What does that mean, work for us? Like, everything comes down to like nuance. Everything in this context comes down to like
these special cases and how we identify things and whether a vendor is a partner or a partner is a vendor, or in this case, you know, what they're saying is like they work with us. I don't understand. And it's so, how can anyone understand this? And then AT&T, I don't have to dive into it. Just, you know, it says their policies are publicly available, so anyone could, you know, dig in and find out their personal data is being used, but it's not something you'd normally do. So what's more often, you have to wade through walls of text scattered across many pages full of vague and confusing language to make sense of privacy policies. Sometimes we only learn about the data practices of mobile operators when there's a data breach exposed, you know, and it's published online. It says, in March this year, a data breach of a third-party AT&T marketing vendor revealed that nearly 9 million AT&T customers had their data, such as their names, account numbers, phone numbers, email addresses, devices used, and installment agreement dates. And it was shared with a marketer. And so a lot of this information is collected, shared with the marketer, and the marketer gets breached. It's not like necessarily always AT&T is like getting breached, but now these 9 million suckers, data and everything. I mean, that's everything. Your name, your account number, your phone number, your email address, devices used, the installment agreements. I mean, that's everything that you would want about the subscribers. So anyway, it's a pretty long article. And I'll have it posted in the show notes as well. This was on AdGuard. There's a couple other things that I have as well, and I'll have those links in the show notes. But one thing I do want to say, though, is if for those that like using AirPlay, or not AirPlay, gosh, I'm losing my mind. AirDrop. Sorry, just total brain fart. AirDrop. So AirDrop is a cool feature. If you have an iOS device and someone else has an iOS device, you can use AirDrop to transfer all sorts of stuff, files, pictures, you know, that kind of thing, videos, and it's done wirelessly. And for a long time, I've been kind of like trying different apps to make my life a little easier to transfer stuff from one device to the other. And so in this context, I've been talking about like an iPhone that I have and then my Pixel 8, or I'm sorry, not a Pixel 8, my Pixel 7 Pro. I want to just easily transfer stuff, but I don't want to have to like upload it to Nextcloud, download it from Nextcloud, that kind of thing. So Local Send is a really cool open source app, and I've been using it, and it works across all devices, even my computer, my Mac, Linux. It's written in Rust, so the UI is clean, and it's the same. It's consistent across all platforms, which is really, really sweet. I like that consistency. And you can just wirelessly transfer. Like, I think you all have to be on the same Wi-Fi, but if it's your own devices, that's probably the case anyways. And yeah, you can just easily, you can give each device its simple name. You know, I've tried some of the other ones in the past. I think what was the one I was using for a while, but it just always crapped. A Snapdrop, was it Snapdrop? What was it called? Snapdrop, does that sound right? I think it was Snapdrop. Yeah, Snapdrop. But half the time, it just didn't work well. Not poo-pooing on it, but Local Send, it's going to be my favorite, new favorite FOSS app. And definitely check it out. Even if you have just all Androids or whatever, like, it's still great to have because you can just transfer stuff real easily from, so like, your desktop to your phone or back and forth. This is for file transfer without losing any resolution. So like, you have a high resolution images and you want to, I just want these to move these from my phone to my computer real fast. You don't have to go plug in your USB cable and none of that stuff. You just Local Send it right to your desktop, and then you could edit those photos and then drop them right back. And then you can post them like wherever you want to post them. So Local Send, badass application, highly recommend. And it's free and open source, which is cool. And another cool update that was fairly recent with Graphene OS is one of my gripes was that I'm a meme collector. I'm a professional meme collector. If you're in any of my group chats or you're in the OT Closed Network Matrix channel, you'll see dropping memes is kind of like what we do. So you see a funny meme somewhere and you screenshot it on your phone, and you just easily want to crop and save. Like, you don't want to go through a bunch of hoops or do any markup. It's been kind of a pain. Well, there is an image editor on the stock Pixel called Markup Tool, and Graphene OS has actually rolled this out. And what they've done is, this is actually an app That isn't available through Google Play, but it's like a Google Pixel app that comes stock with the Google Pixel phone from Google. So what they've done is they've actually added it to their own apps repository. So if you install Graphene OS on your phone, you have one app by default from Graphene called Apps. And in that Apps app, you can install things like Sandbox Google Play. You can install now, I mentioned it on the previous podcast or a couple podcasts ago, the Android Auto. So if you have Android Auto compatible car, you can use that with your Graphene OS device. And now at the very bottom, they have markup, which is cool. So you can just install the markup app from here and it's updated through Graphene OS's like app, built-in app. So you don't have to go manually update it. What this does is really cool. So if you see something, there's a meme, you take a quick screenshot of your phone, which on mine, this is a Pixel 7 Plus, is the lock button and the down volume. I press and hold that. It takes a screenshot. Then now I can click the pencil. I can always, you know, it says like, what do you want to open it up with? I can just say just once or always edit with markup. And then I can just boop, boop, crop, crop, save. Boom. Now I can just do whatever I want, like post that meme wherever I want. I don't know. Two cool things that I found out about that I've been using a lot is the markup tool on Graphene OS. Make your life a lot easier for cropping stuff and doing markup to an image that you're screenshotting. And the second is local send. Whew, that was a lot. Hopefully this wasn't boring. I feel like maybe I kind of drifted into some overlapped topics here. But basically, I kind of just want to start slowly sounding the bell for being on the watch and the lookout for these things, which is anything that increases surveillance on your personal devices and into the services that you use under the guise that it's for protecting kids or anti-terrorism, anti-money laundering. It's another key word to listen out for. This is kind of tinfoil hat stuff, right? But it's not tinfoil hat. This is all online. It's right there. It's in front of you. You can go read this stuff. All the links are in the show notes. So anti-money laundering, and then AI. And not just AI in general, but like AI as it pertains to assisting you with anything. Hey, we can, if you just install Copilot on your machine or you just install this in your app and this and that, whatever, like whatever it's going to be, Gemini AI, whatever Apple and Google are going to be working out, I can tell you right now that will be, probably the end of line for a lot of people that are kind of like privacy security aware, adjacent, if you will, but aren't really kind of committed to dump all their stuff. That might be a good dumping point. Just like Linux user base has finally grown over 4% user base now. That's huge. Think how many computers there are in the world, right? And just to have 4% of anything is massive. And I think that's becoming because Windows sucks so much. It's garbage. Not only is it just like bloated, it's like really obnoxious. It gets in the way. There's all these search highlights and picture. I mean, it's baked in ads right to the operating system. It's disgusting. And it's just, at some point, you start to realize, you start asking yourself, like, why am I spending so much money on hardware and software licenses just for the very software provider to also be ramming ads down my throat just by clicking on the start button? Like, this is seriously offensive. It's gross. It's disgusting. I don't have a problem with ads in general, but when they're baked into the OS layer and the operating system is spying and analyzing everything that you're doing to best perform to be the best ad delivery mechanism for a publisher, and you paying money for this operating system, you're paying a licensing fee for this operating system, it's abhorrent and it disgusts me. And it just makes me want to literally burn everything to the ground and start fresh with open hardware, supporting companies like System 76 who are opening up hardware, their hardware specifications, creating awesome free and open source software to use, supporting projects like Graphene OS, like literally untethering from everything that's like basically got icky poo poo all over it, and I don't want to touch it. That's really what it's getting it's getting close to. So
it might be a disgusting metaphor to use to finish the podcast with. So I do apologize for that, but I want to thank you very much for being here. I want to thank you for all of the people who keep this thing going. If you want to be a part of the community, all you got to do is download the Element app. It's everywhere. It's on everything. And then go to Closed Network. You just create an account. You just go to element.io, create an account. Then go to closednetwork.io and click join the Matrix chat. And we also have an off-topic channel, which is pretty much like just for memes and fun and hanging out. I'm going to reattempt now that I'm feeling better. We're going to reattempt the privacy bar. So have some open hangouts and be able to talk to one another in a privacy respecting way, probably using something like Jitsi Meet or something where you can just click and just need a microphone and we can just chat and hang out, talk about the things that we're working on, whether it's self-hosted solutions and Nextcloud or firewalls and internet routers, all that fun stuff. I implore you, no matter how technical you are, try to become the best nerd you can possibly be, because it's gonna save you. It's gonna help you for the coming years and like what's coming next. And I'm not just talking about corporate surveillance tech. I'm talking about everything and protecting yourself from identity theft, from being a potential target for ransomware viruses or Trojans. Like being very vigilant, being very aware about what your car is doing and reporting about you, what your phone is doing, what your internet provider, and how to protect yourself. There are ways to protect yourself. And that's what we talk about all day in our chat room and just hanging out. I'm working with some ideas on deploying maybe a discourse forum. I would love some feedback on that, where we can, kind of have the articles, but also have like, it's kind of like a wiki, but there's a lot of stuff going on with it. It's just kind of like a central hub of knowledge. I'll just kind of refer to it as that. It's open source software. We would be hosting it ourselves on our own server, whether that's on a box that's physically running out of my house and then being backed up somewhere, or on a VPS. We're still figuring that out, but it would be self-hosted. If anyone has any input about that, or if you have some like technical chops to like help out with me and Mattis Max and Unintelligent 7 with infrastructure stuff, please reach out to me. You can send me a DM on Matrix. You can hit me on Mastodon or Twitter, or shoot me an email, simon@closednetwork.io. And let me know. Cause I appreciate all the help and support, whether it's financial, whether it's sharing the podcast, whether it's providing feedback or helping out with infrastructure stuff. So time, talent, treasure, those are that's the ethos I've adopted from one of my favorite podcasts, No Agenda Social, is time, talent, treasure. So any of those you can donate, super appreciated. Okay, so until next time, I hope you all have a fantastic week. I hope I didn't bring you down with all of this like toxic crap going on out there. I don't really want to make anyone afraid. I want you to feel empowered. I want you to arm up and fight these guys. Fight what's and you know what? That may be some inner conversations with yourself. Am I ready to become a criminal? And that's something that I know a lot of people don't take lightly. I don't, but these are kind of things that you might have to start thinking about if you're in the European Union and you self-host your own wallets. You're probably having that conversation with yourself right now, and that's okay. I'm here for it. This is unjust stuff going on. I'm trying real hard not to use expletives. So, anyway, come talk in an encrypted format with us and share your thoughts and ideas. Thanks for listening. And if you have any suggestions, please hit me up. Until next time, it's Simon. I'll catch you on the flip side. Okay. They can never keep me down, I'm going. And if I ever fail, just know I'll go again. I never quit, cause I know that every loss may lead to another win. I'm going up. I bet when I land, they gon' tell me it's luck again. See that I'm winning, it's harder to watch. I'm setting the stage, you should give me my props. You ain't got a soul, you lacking the spirit. You talk out your neck, I'ma show you I'm with it.